From Jefferson Public Radio at Southern Oregon University, this is the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Coming up after the news, working to bring bees back from the brink. You've heard plenty in the news for several years now about colony collapse disorder and other issues facing bees, a real problem because bees pollinate so much of our food supply. Enter the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project. Founder Dave Curtis will join us, along with three other people who know bees, Laura Ferguson, John Jacobs, and Sarah Redlaird. They'll share their knowledge of the animals and what they do, and we'll get into the specifics of the Pollinator Project, which is meant to enhance the environment for honeybees, to make them healthier and hardier, and help out all the things that depend on bees. Bees and the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project, and your phone calls and emails ahead on the Jefferson Exchange. First, the news of the hour. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. We broadcast live weekday mornings and rebroadcast weekday evenings on radio stations serving California and Oregon. And we are found online as well at jeffexchange.org. It is Friday, September 6, 2013. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Glad you're along for the ride today. Happy Friday to you. In this hour, bees and their importance to all of us and efforts to make sure they're still around doing what bees do. You'll hear from people who work with bees about their efforts, including the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project. And you can join our discussion on the exchange. You'll hear the phone numbers and the email address shortly. First, a weather forecast from our student assistant, Reed Newland.
On the Northern California coast today, windy and mostly cloudy, then gradually becoming sunny with patchy fog and a high near 67. In Redding and Red Bluff, sunny and windy with the high around 92. In Yreka, sunny with a high near 82. In Whedon Mount Shasta, sunny with a high around 80. On the southern Oregon coast, cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny with patchy fog, a slight chance of showers, and a high around 70. In the Klamath Basin, mostly sunny with a high near 74. In Grants Pass, Medford, and Ashland, mostly sunny with a high near 83. In the southern Oregon Cascades and Siskiyous, cloudy through mid-morning, then gradually clearing with a high near 65. In Roseburg and the Umpqua Basin, cloudy through mid-morning, then gradually clearing with a slight chance of showers and a high near 78. And in Eugene and Springfield today, cloudy through mid-morning, then gradually clearing with rain likely, and a high near 73.
But the gradually clearing is going to be a fairly complete clearing. That little puff of clouds that came through yesterday, it just sort of evaporated on us. And now it looks like Washington State is getting the precipitation we had yesterday. Any lingering precipitation will be gone and probably stay gone for a while. We're looking for a pretty good summer weekend around the region, with temperatures getting back up into the 90s in the Rogue Valley for sure, and up into the upper 70s in the Willamette Valley. So another summer weekend before we get to the official end of summer later in the month, and a warm set of days to enjoy. Thanks for listening to us on the Jefferson Exchange today. We're always glad for your time and attention. And if you'd like to join us on the exchange, you're more than welcome to do so. Phone numbers are as follows, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. And our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. When piles of honeybees showed up dead in a parking lot in northern Oregon this summer, it made news across the country. We're more aware over time of the great importance of bees to our food supply and the great challenges that bees face, including the still mysterious colony collapse disorder. It also helps that Time magazine came out with a cover story a few weeks ago called A World Without Bees. Beekeepers and handlers in the Rogue Valley are pushing a concept called the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project, and they're bringing one of the bigger names in bees to the Valley this weekend. We have several guests, all quite familiar with bees and their value to us. Laura B. Ferguson is with the College of the Melissa and the Center for Sacred Beekeeping. Laura, welcome.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Good to have you. Sarah Redlaird is with us. She's with beegirl.org, where she's involved in training and education. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. Thank you.
Dave Curtis is the founder of Wild Bee International and the creator of the Rogue Valley Pollinator Project. Hi, Dave.
Good morning. Thank you.
And John Jacobs is with us as well. He's the Southern Oregon representative of the Beekeepers Association and Old Soul Enterprises. John, welcome.
Thank you.
So let's go around the table briefly and just to get some idea of how long you've been working with bees and in what capacity. So, John, let's start with you.
I've been working with bees since 1997, and my specialty is queen breeding. We breed for disease-resistant honeybees, and we also do a lot of commercial pollination. We do about half the pear acreage here in the valley.
So bees has always been a full-time job for you for a long time?
Exceedingly full-time.
Oh, exceedingly full-time, more than just full-time. Dave Curtis, your experience with bees and how you got into it.
Well, actually, I'm not quite born into them, but from the age of 6 years old, my father started raising bees, and I grew up from that point and actually have written a book about those early experiences between 1960 and 74. And have been in and out of the business all my life.
And Sarah Redlaird, what attracted you to bees?
My family had bees on their farm when I was a kid, so that kind of planted the seed of affinity. And then I left it for a while and came back in college at the University of Montana and started as a research project for the Honors College. And then by the time I graduated, I was offered a job as a researcher for the university. So I did that for a while. And then I moved back here to Southern Oregon and started my nonprofit.
And is that beegirl.org?
Yes.
So what goes on at beegirl.org?
Oh, all sorts of things. So we primarily work on conservation and education. Under education, I work with beginning beekeepers, and I travel the U.S. quite a bit doing public talks, public speaking, just letting people know about honeybees and their importance to us and our food. And I also work with kids a lot. I'm the program chair and program director for the American Beekeeping Federation Kids and Bees Program. I'm also working as an ambassador for the Bee World Project under the International Bee Research Association based out of the UK. And we hope to be doing some collaborative work between the UK, Africa, and the United States in the next year. And let's see, what else do I do? Oh, conservation. On the conservation front, I'm the Oregon Outreach Coordinator for the Bee Friendly Farming Initiative. And so I work with farmers and other land managers to plant for our honeybees. And I also work on policy. We just recently got city beekeeping legalized in the city of Ashland, Oregon. So big win there.
That's a coup. All right. And Laura B. Ferguson. You want to be known as Laura B. Ferguson, I see.
Yeah.
Center for Sacred Beekeeping. This is probably the most interesting title of the bunch around the table today.
Well, it's definitely a unique program. I've been working on this for 2 years. And what I'm doing with Sacred Beekeeping is really hoping to awaken the personal relationship with the honeybee, because it's a very... It's a magical creature that gives us lots and lots of information, and throughout history has been revered as a very special creature. And it's been really industrialized, of course, like a lot of our agriculture. So I have developed a curriculum with a few other people, and we do an online school as well as an on-the-ground school. We have people all over the country learning about the history and the mystery and the science about the honeybee. So we're trying to take a real holistic studying viewpoint, including science, with when you punch through the science, you find these real miracles about the bee, and it's just very inspirational. So we've really starting to have fun with this concept. I've been a beekeeper for about 10 years, and my entrance into beekeeping started when I was a child, though I saw some bees in an observation hive at OMSI, and I was immediately smitten once I heard the sound through the glass. It captured my heart. So,
but there was a real break there, and you got actually into beekeeping as a lifestyle as an adult.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It actually kind of overtook me. It sort of was my son grew up, and I realized that this is what I want to do. And our focus is really on activism. We would like to be very present and vocal about protecting the bee and all pollinators. I think all of us here, even though we all are working with bees, we are big fans of the pollinator in general.
All right, so other pollinators, not just bees. Let's talk about the change over time, though. It seems like, in a way, and I'm going to put this one to either Dave or John, that the colony collapse disorder may have actually helped in the sense that it certainly drew attention to bees and their importance. A sense of importance that might not have existed without people going, uh-oh, this is a real problem.
Unfortunately, it takes those kind of events to create the power and focus on situations sometimes, and that certainly is the case with the honeybee.
And, John, how severe has the situation gotten in Southern Oregon?
Well, a lot of guys have had big losses. I can't speak to anybody in specific, but I mean, some guys have lost 80% or more. Pollination prices are going up on almost every crop you can name, so there are definitely real challenges. You know, the old adage is crisis equals opportunity, so this crisis has brought up a much-needed research interest, and so there's going to be some good that comes out of it.
All right, much more to talk about bees, beekeeping, the importance to agriculture, and the Rogue Valley Pollinator Project coming up on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join our conversation with John, Dave, Sarah, and Laura. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with them and with your phone calls in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today about bees and beekeeping and the importance of bees to not only agriculture, but by extension to all of us because of how much of our food supply is tied up with pollination brought about by bees. You can join us here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about that subject generally and get more specifically into the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project and what that's all about. We have Dave Curtis with us, who's the founder of Wild Bee International and the Rogue Valley Pollinator Project, John Jacobs from the Beekeepers Association and Old Soul Enterprises, Sarah Redlaird from BeeGirl.org, and Laura B. Ferguson from College of the Melissa Center for Sacred Beekeeping. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to come back to Laura because you'd mentioned getting in relatively recently. Of the people in this room, you got in the last 15 years or so. I'm going to have to fix that mic stand. It's going to make some noise. But how hard or easy was it to get into this line of work?
I think it's super easy to get into it. How you manage it as a career is a whole nother story. It's not a real, at this point, it's a real labor of love. And how easy was it? It's as easy as falling in love for me. It was, it absolutely overtook me. And when I realized the absolute implications of what beekeeping means to humanity and what it means to this current environmental crisis. CCD is not just a beekeeping crisis. This is an environmental crisis of monumental proportions. They're a canary in a coal mine. So when I realized how beautiful not only the species is for our agriculture and our life, it's a gorgeous metaphor for how humanity can help heal the world and heal our relationship with nature. So how easy was it to get involved? It was as easy as falling downstairs or falling in love for me, that's for sure.
I was waiting for you to get to the falling in love part. As easy as falling in love, yes. And we can debate the easy or easiness or difficulty of that. Just around the room then, how concerned are any of you about where we stand with bees and bee populations now versus just a few years ago?
I have a major concern myself, and that is the basis and the reason for why I'm sitting here today and advocating the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project.
All right, and John Jacobs?
Well, we live in a world where a lot of farming practices are hostile towards pollinators. We're also dealing with some issues with our state and local government allowing bees as farm use on certain soil types. There are a lot of challenges facing beekeeping right now. So projects like Dave's are a great way for us to synergize and do something positive in this hostile environment.
So, Dave, let's talk about the Rogue Valley, the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project. It's confined to the Upper Rogue, at least in concept here. And I had a chance to look at your PowerPoint presentation. What are you trying to do? What are the goals of the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project in the first place?
Well, the ultimate goal is through a coalition of different entities and levels of the community all the different segments of our community, both farming and education, to ultimately recreate a new environment within our valley due to the fact that we happen to live in a very special area surrounded by mountains that has the possibility for creating this kind of a project that couldn't be created elsewhere.
So are bees able to live in lots of different habitats? I mean, is there an optimum habitat for them? It sounds like, I mean, because they seem to be able to find homes in suburban and urban environments as well as rural.
Well, yes. I mean, bees are extremely adaptive. However, due to the situations that not just the honeybees, but all our pollinators are facing, we are currently looking at, as the USDA has announced, the possibility of a major food crisis. And this Upper Oak Pollinator Project is a project designed not just to rebuild our own community and our own environment, but done so in a way to assist our landowners and ranchers in a way to where we can create a whole new beekeeping industry and bring a whole new entity of beekeeping hopefully to be shown elsewhere around the world as a possible project for others to see and follow.
So is it habitat enhancement? Is it more people keeping
bees? It's habitat
bees?
Exactly. It's involved with habitat. It's involved with the farming. It's involved with education. There's a hope because, again, we are living in with the effects of climate change. Southern Oregon has been fairly buffered up till now, but we are still caught up in it. And the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project is advanced, proactive measure to try to already get started on helping our own community.
We've all, a couple of you have mentioned other pollinators. I think, Sarah, you were one of them. Who are some of the other pollinators in addition to bees?
Ooh, well, we've got bumblebees. So we all primarily work with honeybees. Honeybees are the little striped, fuzzy, brown or black and yellow bees that work our food primarily, and we're able to move them in hives. They come in those movable white boxes that you might see in orchards or by the side of the road. But they're, to me, honeybees are more, they're like farm workers. We take them into our orchards. They work for us. They essentially work for free. The beekeepers get paid, but the bees don't get paid anything. And then there's this whole other sect of pollinators and bees, and they're more like the wildlife. And so we have bumblebees, we have mason bees, we have leafcutter bees, we've got minor bees. And the majority of these bees do a fantastic service for a lot of our berries and our foods, as well as our wildlands and our wild areas, our wildflowers and our trees. And so they're very important as well. And they're just as affected by the habitat loss and the pesticides as the honeybees are.
We have a couple of questions here already. Jeannie in Medford wants to know if yellow jackets pollinate like bees. John Jacobs, you want to take that one on?
Sure. I have seen them actually doing some pollination. They're kind of a generalist opportunist. They do scavenge carrion, but I've also seen them on flowers gathering pollen.
All right, so the yellow jackets, yes. And let's take another. Whoops, looks like he got off the line here. Or unless that's back him on. No, okay. There was a question here that Jamie and Medford didn't stay on the line for, but he wanted to get a little contrast of European honeybees to the ones that we have around here.
We do. We have European honeybees here. That's the Apis mellifera, is the honeybee that is predominant in America. Apis scutentella is the Africanized honeybee, which is coming this direction from South America. They pretty much came up through the Texas, California area, and then hung a right, so they're headed towards Florida. So as for now, the climate is not warm enough for Africanized honeybees to come up our way, but we'll see what happens with climate change on the horizon.
But let me understand that there are bees that are indigenous to our region. There are bees that were here before settlers came.
No, actually,
really?
The European honeybee, Apis mellifera, came over to the U.S. in about 1630. And so they've been here for a very long time. They came over as a sugar resource for the settlers. But at this point, I think that saying there's a dichotomy of honeybees versus native bees is really doing a disservice to everyone, because all of the issues that affect native bees also affect honeybees. And they've been here since 1630. They're not going anywhere. So there's wild bees. There's bees that live in trees, honeybees that live in trees in the forest, but there's no native honeybee.
But other kinds of bees.
There are native, like the bumblebee is native, leafcutter bees can be native, the orchard bee is native.
And some of the natives are in trouble, like the Franklin bumblebee. Have we even seen them? Are they gone?
Actually, there was a spotting this year of the Franklin's honeybee. So up in the Siskiyou region by Willowert Ranch. So yeah, there was a spotting. So there's definitely...
I know your mic stand is sinking. I will come fix it as soon as I get to ask somebody else a question.
I'm going to end up on the floor here really soon. Yeah. I think that there's definitely hope. There has been, there are quite a few species of bumblebees that are endangered. The bumblebee actually beat out the baby seal this year for the endangered species chocolate bar label. So
really?
People are really starting to take notice. Great. That the bumblebees are in trouble and they need help and they need awareness. But people really are starting to motivate and go the right direction.
All right. We'll talk more about the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project and bees and their welfare in the world with Sarah Redlaird, you just heard, Laura Ferguson, Dave Curtis, and John Jacobs. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. You might have lots of comments or questions. Our phone number is 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Dave Curtis, then, who needs to embrace the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project? Who needs to get active on this?
The whole community. Again, this concept is just now actually being discussed between not just the group that are here, but others that are very important. Hopefully after Randy Oliver's presentation this weekend, which is a major, major presentation for Southern Oregon, in regards to the current knowledge and science that's currently coming out in regards to the honeybee, everyone's focus and concern on him. We're very fortunate to have him here tomorrow presenting at the South Medford High School Theater.
All right, so let's start with the easy stuff. Who is Randy Oliver? Why is he so important to people who know bees?
Randy Oliver is a beekeeper, biologist, researcher. And a combination, first off, a beekeeper, and secondly, involved with major research projects going on in regards to issues with the honeybee.
All right. So then moving on, I mean, the people who can help put the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project into effect, who would those be?
Rancher associations, the Farm Bureau Association, all are... The USDA, NRCS are different sectors. There's other major organizations. Cal Creek Indians is a possibility or could play a key role in this project. And besides our universities and schools, and again, the beekeeping beekeeping leaders, so to speak, some of which are here today, but there are others out there also, all can play a key role in the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project.
And so, John Jacobs, how would somebody like yourself get involved in the Upper Rogue Pollinator Project? What kinds of things would you do to help implement the ideas behind it?
Well, I would be supportive in any collaborative level. I mean, if you eat food, you're a stakeholder in pollinator health, and
which means everybody,
pretty much. So we're all deeply concerned. So you know, I can reach out through my industry connections to build support, but also anybody in the community, you know, can help with this project.
When I posed the question to Laura about how easy or hard it was to get into the business, I deliberately didn't pose that to you, but because you've been in it for many, many years. But is there a growth? Is this a growth business? I mean, fate of the bees aside, I mean, are there more people who are interested in getting into bee management now, beekeeping?
Well, hobby beekeeping has just boomed, especially since, you know, a lot of community awareness has happened with the colony collapse disorder, or CCD. But honestly, commercial operations... It's an aging demographic. There are a lot less commercial beekeepers. The average size of a large outfit has gotten bigger, so there's fewer but bigger operators. And most of these guys are pretty old. You know, at 44, I'm relatively a whippersnapper to a lot of these guys. So we need to start encouraging more people to take it up as a trade.
Is this just the general trend in agriculture that the people are aging and fewer young people want to get into the business?
Well, yeah, it parallels what's happening in a lot of other farms. You know, there's consolidations and big agribusiness getting involved. But, you know, beekeeping takes a special person. It is difficult work, and the hours are long. And, you know, if you didn't love it, not a lot of people would want to do it. But like Laura said, it's easy to fall in love with bees.
So, Laura, when you're handling bees, do you get stung very much? I mean, this is always the question that people ask.
Yeah, I do. I do get stung a lot, but I think all of us can say that if we work gently with the bees and if we minimize like aggressive actions with our bees, if you just handle them gently, it becomes a relationship, and pretty much we can take the hit by now. You know, it's like getting hit with a hammer or something. Sometimes it doesn't hurt anymore as much.
If you're in the construction business, you're going to bash your thumb once in a while.
Right, exactly, and it mostly hurts the bee worse than it hurts me. So,
all right, let's all make sure we have headphones on because we have several calls here. Let's go to Sheila in Grants Pass first. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Laura B. Ferguson, Dave Curtis, Sarah Redlaird, and John Jacobs.
Oh, yes. So I wanted to ask a question to everybody because I'm not even in the whippersnapper category. I'm listening. I've been interested in beekeeping just at a distance. But how does someone like me who knows basically nothing except for the education I've been learning very recently, how do I participate in supporting you folks in your awesome endeavors to bring our pollinators to a better balanced state and to help our world?
Sheila, thanks for the question. John Jacobs sat up taller in his chair to answer that one. Go ahead, John.
Well, a lot of people want to help out with bees, but don't necessarily have the skills or the interest to be actual beekeepers. So, you know, supporting David's project is one way. But, you know, how we landscape, you know, what we choose to plant in our gardens, what we choose to spray on our gardens, these are all things that if we're conscientious of, you can have a beneficial impact on your local neighborhood pollinators right in your yard. I mean, it's very important that we try to replace habitat loss through smart landscaping, planting bee-friendly plants that bloom at the right times of the year.
So in a sense, you can be somewhat passive in your approach. In other words, you don't have to own bees or have hives, but you can at least make places that are bee-friendly.
Sure. Well, it's this group action that, I mean, we have to ask ourselves, how did we get here? Why is there a bee shortage? And you could look at how we farm. We could look at how we landscape, what we spray. So when we start thinking about the big picture, you know, each of us as individuals can have a huge role to play.
Sarah Redlaird seems to be wanting to get here, too.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, if you're here in Southern Oregon, you can go on to beegirl.org, and under the resources page, there's, I think I put about a dozen plants on there that I worked with the Xerces Society to come up with a good bee-friendly list for honeybees and native pollinators, for a planting list for easy for your yard. And then also another thing that we can all do to really help bees, which seems like really indirect and abstract, but it really would help, is to just eat more organic food. And really, I like to say, shake the hand that feeds you. Go to the farmer's market, talk to the people that are growing your food, and ask them, do you spray pesticides? Do you consider bees when you spray pesticides? Do you plant for your bees in addition to just growing fruits and vegetables? And so being able to connect with our farmers and being able to eat food that's more sustainably farmed is, if we only eat as a country 5% organic food at this point. But if we could boost that up to just 20%, like if every day you have 3 or more times a day to vote with your fork. And if you could just eat just a little bit more organic food, it'd make a big difference. There's, if you look on the Buy Local Buy Rogue website as well, Eat Local Food Week is coming up, which is an awesome time to be able to participate in your local food shed if you're here in Southern Oregon.
And Laura, you wanted to get in here too.
I certainly do. You know, from my perspective, this honeybee crisis is a huge environmental crisis. So, you know, you can take seeds and put them in, like flower seeds, and put them in vacant lots. That's like a great level of activism. Or you can really seriously take on a concern or an issue such as a pesticide or a GMO question and really advocate, because if we realize that 70% around of our bees are disappearing every single year, this is absolutely global crisis go time.
70% a year, really?
Yeah, I mean, it can vary in regions. Like John was saying, you know, some beekeepers are losing 80 to 100%. This is, you know, and we're reproducing bees every single year, you know. So, you know, the reason why the loss isn't bigger is because people like John are working overtime to develop, you know, and work with bees. So, you know, to make more colonies happen for us. You know, this is a huge crisis, and it needs to be handled on an environmental global level.
Much more to talk about bees, beekeeping, and how we can all help out to save the bees. Join us here on the Jefferson Exchange. When we return, your phone calls are welcome in a minute five. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about bees, honeybees, bumblebees, you name it, the bees that pollinate all the products that end up as agricultural products. In other words, the food we eat largely depends on bees, and we have people here concerned about them enough to want to do something about them. Laura B. Ferguson is with the College of the Melissa Center for Sacred Beekeeping. Sarah Red Laird runs beegirl.org. She's involved in training and education and often wears black and yellow tops. Dave Curtis is the founder of Wild Bee International and the Rogue Valley Pollinator Project, which is a discussion topic here today. And John Jacobs is the Southern Oregon representative with the Beekeepers Association and also runs Old Soul Enterprises. Your comments and questions about bees and the fate of bees and how we can make that fate a little better down the road are welcome. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Or send us an email to jx@jeffnet.org. Let's go to Marcy in Eureka. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi there. Speaking of landscaping, apparently I do have a bee-friendly landscape because as I was trimming a ground cover, it's Ceanothus, which I think that the bees really like, I discovered a nest. It must be in the ground. And it stung my friend when we were working, so we kind of skedaddled out of there. My question to you is there a quiet time of the year with these bees? I need to do some heavy landscaping about 10 or 15 feet away from these guys, and I don't want to upset them, so I want to let them do their thing. Any ideas on a time of year?
Let's go back to Bee Girl, Sarah Redlair. Thanks for the call, Marcy.
If they lived in the ground and they came after you with their stingers, they're actually a wasp. They're a yellow jacket. They're not a bee. Bees that live in the ground typically don't sting. A lot of our native bees don't have stingers, and they don't come out in full force after you. So the best thing that you could do is put out yellow jacket traps around your property in the spring, and that way you can catch the queens before they even, because the worker wasps don't live through the winter. And so in the spring, before they make their colonies, if you can catch those queens, then that's your first good bet. Second, if you do identify a yellow jacket wasp nest and it's somewhere where you need to be landscaping, you can put a glass bowl over the entrance and they will try and come up and get really confused and not dig another alternative entrance. They'll just stay in there and essentially die. But it's okay because then something like a skunk will dig them up and have them for lunch. And so it's just the cycle of life.
Okay. So you're actually helping the environment in some way. Laura.
And also when you're working on landscaping your yard, always leave a portion of your yard untilled so that you can support the other kinds of ground living pollinators, such as bumblebees like to often make their nests in the ground. So leaving some wild lands on your property is a great way to sustain native pollinators.
All right, so it's just a one section of your property that you don't do anything with. Makes sense. John Jacobs, since we're talking about queens, and you actually provide most of the queens in the Rogue Valley, it sounds like, this is a very specialized part of beekeeping, isn't it? And how do you do all this handling?
Well, it is. There is a reason why not everybody goes into queen production. It's fairly demanding schedule-wise. You have to be able to be a meticulous planner and then also be willing to have Mother Nature scramble those plans on a moment's notice at the last minute.
Sounds like agriculture.
Yeah. Well, and with queens, you know, we operate our cell builders on about a 10-day cycle. So from the time I graft a young larva, you know, I have 10 days till it's mature enough that we can go out and place them in little breeder hives to get the queens mated.
Okay. So the queens already exist and you go get them, or you're making queens?
I make them from 24-hour-old larva. You know, any worker larva can become a queen honeybee if it's fed the appropriate diet. So what I do is I gear up some special hives called cell builders that are really interested in making queens. You know, I stimulate their instincts to want to make queens. So I give them a bunch of the appropriate age larvae at a time, up to 40 at a time. And then the cell builders draw out these cells. And then the first queen to hatch would go out and destroy the other competition. So I separate them before they hatch. And then that way they emerge into some special mating hives. And then they're worth something after they're mated. You know, prior to mating, they're not worth much.
That's really interesting, though, that really anybody can become a queen. It just depends on what the diet is.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, forage is really important. You know, the more diverse and more abundant it is, the more prolific they'll be able to make queens and more hives.
Let us take some more questions from our listeners. Let's go to Pam in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking bees with John Jacobs, Sarah Redlaird, Laura Ferguson, and Dave Curtis.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question concerning the systemic insecticides, not the ones that are sprayed, but the ones that are put in the ground that go through the system of the plant. And has there been any more specific research done on that to know if that's one of the causes of a collapse disorder?
Anybody want to judge John Jacobs?
Well, there's a lot of debate on that right now. There have been some studies that show linkage. You know, it's a multifactorial situation. You know, it's often the analogy given, you know, the last straw that breaks the camel's back. Which one do you blame? That being said, these systemics have a lot of unintended consequences. You know, we're actually having an impact, even if it's only sublethal impact on a beehive. In some cases, it's been shown to be sublethal. You know, the honeybee was not the target, so you know it's not a very target-specific method. So, I think more research needs to be done. There's been some concern that there's a revolving door between the regulatory agencies and the companies that manufacture these. So sometimes there's a debate about, you know, how well these approvals are made for these products.
And Dave Curtis?
Yeah. Randy Oliver is currently very involved doing research work with quite a few other other entities and universities and private parties that are currently doing working on the synergies that can be formed between the different chemicals that not just agriculture people are using, but also our commercial beekeepers in regards to miticides and different products that they're using to help protect their bees and keep them alive. And so tomorrow's event is going to be extremely informational as far as bringing us abreast to where we truly are today in the science world. I know we've got a lot of great people out there with great research and great information available, but Randy, again, is a beekeeper, and he's really got a great handle on being able to tie these two sides of science and on-the-ground beekeeping together and in a very understanding way. And so I'm really looking forward to this continued research that is currently going on in regards to the synergies between these different chemicals being used.
That's really interesting, though, to think that you would have people who are running beehives, keeping bees, concerned about their health and well-being. They would be using some chemicals to try to get rid of things that could hurt the bees and trying not to hurt the bees at the same time.
Exactly. The biggest pest of beekeeping right now is a mite. It's called the varroa mite, and there is a lot of materials that beekeepers do use to try to control the mite. My position has been to use genetics as our front line of defense. That's a work in
progress. Just make stronger bees.
Yeah, that's a work in progress. I mean, there's a lot of variables there. But, you know, we are making progress. We have more hygienic bees that do handle mites better. I won't say that they're 100% mite-proof, but that is our goal, is to use genetics first.
All right, before we get too far away from just talking about Randy Oliver, I want to give the folks a chance to know when and where they can see him.
South Medford High School Theater, a great setting, tomorrow at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Tickets available at the door.
All right, so Saturday at 1 o'clock at South Medford High School. And Laura B. Ferguson, is there something you wanted to add here?
Yeah, I just wanted to speak to pesticides. This whole issue is very, very complicated, and I really doubt that, you know, with the way that, you know, certain research is being done in this country, I really doubt that we're going to be able to find a definitive answer. For example, B-Logix was a major player in finding out the causes for colony collapse, and they were recently bought by Monsanto, I think, a couple years ago. So, you know, we really have I think you could talk to any single beekeeper, and they will know that when you're applying an herbicide, pesticide, or fungicide to a garden, you're going to be affecting the animals that drink the nectar, drink the water on a leaf that's aspirating, or eating the pollen. It's pretty much a no-brainer. We have clear evidence that neonicotinoids and these other kinds of pesticides are hurting bees. And any beekeeper can tell you if an orchard is sprayed and their bees die the next day, it doesn't sign, you know, we don't need a research grant to understand that this is a lethal. And then the other thing is that there's a synergistic effect and a long-term effect with these bees. It takes a while sometimes. And like John was talking about sublethal level, there's different chemicals will work together to really weaken a hive that makes it more susceptible to the wide variety of diseases that are available to the bee right now.
Well, let's take another call. We have Pam and Dexter on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Laura Ferguson, John Jacobs, Dave Curtis, and Sarah Redlaird.
Hi. Well, I'm really happy to know that anyone can be a queen.
And not just
I was
for a
calling
day.
Because in Eugene, there's a group that's working on the local level, and they're contacting all the locally owned businesses that sell the neonicotinoid pesticides, which I think a lot of them are made by Bayer. And there was there's sheets going around with the lists of what they are exactly, what the label looks like, and people are going to the stores and asking them to take them off the shelves, and if they won't take them off the shelves, at least educate people on what these neonicotinoids do. And then I had a question about all the wineries. I was wondering if all the non-organic wineries in the area in Oregon, if they use these neonicotinoids, because that's a growing industry as California heats up and the wineries are moving north and expanding. And just if you have any information on that, and thanks for your work. I think it's really – there was a – I saw a video of in China, they're actually hand-pollinating the fruit trees in some areas of the country because of the bees are gone. So could you imagine trying to do that?
Wow, that's
and I'll listen on the radio. Thanks.
All right, thanks for the call, Pam. Appreciate it. Sarah Redlaird, want to take this one?
Yeah, so I guess that's kind of a two-part question, statement, comment.
Take them both.
First of all, I think that touches on a really good point. Is I think yes, neonicotinoids probably kill bees, and there's a lot of pesticides, fungicides, and herbicides out there that also harm bees. So I think really what it comes down to for me is management, just proper management. What we saw up in Hillsboro with the 50,000 bumblebees that dropped out of the linden trees was just mismanagement. They sprayed neonicotinoid, the mode of action is either to coat a seed or to use as a spray. And so they sprayed all these trees in a Target parking lot while the trees were in bloom and there was bees foraging on the trees. So that is bad management. And also,
could the same pesticide have been sprayed at a different time with no effect?
It would have had less of an effect. It still would have had an effect for sure, but it would have had less of an effect. It would have been less of a genocide situation as it was. And even on a grander and a smaller scale, you know, management of your own lawn, management of your own garden. Do you really need to have that perfect rose without a little teeny tiny leaf cutter bee or leaf cutter ant circling the leaf? I think that we need to develop more of a tolerance for food and for flowers that are a little less perfect. And also just management on a grand scale. There's a story that I heard of a field in the Midwest where they sprayed prophylactically every year on June 16th. And my friends at the Xerces Society said, well, why do you just spray on June 16th? And they said, oh, because that's typically when the neighbors would plow or mow their or hay their field, and all the leafhoppers would come over to our seed farm and eat all of our seeds. And they're like, well, we looked at June 16th and nobody was haying. And they're like, well, I guess we started doing that about 20 years ago, but we haven't really paid attention to the fact that they don't even run there. Right. There's not even that, that's not even going on anymore. And so they started scouting for pesticide or for pests before they sprayed, and they were it was just amazing the transformation that happened in the region. They were able to bring back pollinators. They were able to bring back amphibians. They brought back birds, and it was just because they were scouting for pests instead of just prophylactically spraying. So management is big. And then the other part of the question
was about wineries.
Was wineries? Yeah. So I've been working with wineries through the Bee Friendly Farming Initiative, and no, the conventional wine grape growers don't spray neonicotinoids. If they do use something, it's usually sulfur, which isn't really known to affect bees. The big thing that I'm trying to work with wineries to do is to plant cover crops between their rows to provide food and provide nectar and pollen for bees in the early spring, and then also, if possible, in the late fall. And because a lot of our hay fields, which have clover and have vetch and have food for bees, are being turned into vineyards, which is awesome. I love to drink wine. I understand that the price point is really high. But just also consider that if you're that's a habitat loss for native bees and for honeybees. And so consider planting sunflowers like along your fence rows, or put in a hedgerow, or put in cover cropping between your rows.
But what I think I hear you saying is that small adjustments can bear some big results.
Absolutely. Exactly. Yes. Yeah.
All right. We're out of time, and one of our callers wanted a contact number for you at beegirl.org. And do you have a phone number you can give out too?
Yeah, it's 541-708-1127.
Okay, I'll make sure we put that on our Facebook page as well, 541-708-1127. That is Sarah Redlaird at beegirl.org. We've also been joined by Laura Ferguson from College of the Melissa Center for Sacred Beekeeping, John Jacobs from the Beekeepers Association and Old Soul Enterprises, and Dave Curtis, the founder of Wild Bee International and the Rogue Valley Pollinator Project. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that will do it for today's Jefferson Exchange. Monday, we'll talk about the birds at the Klamath Refuge and the crisis with water there. We'll talk about the Home of the Clear Cut campaign in Oregon. Then we'll visit with Francesca Marciuliano about I Could Chew on This and Sally Forth, his two major projects of late. That's all Monday on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Charlotte Dern's our producer. Reed Newland, our student assistant. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.